should be treating them and their companies, their government, their products, their services the same way they treat us.
A new report by a U.S. committee takes a hard line on China. It's Thursday, October 11th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are invited to be part of this program. To do that, all you have to do is join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, South Korea considers lifting its sanctions against North Korea. And the premier of Australia's most populous state says too many people are being let in. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Protection of human rights in China has been on a downward trajectory by virtually every measure since President Xi Jinping assumed power in 2012. That is according to a U.S. congressional study concluded on Wednesday. The report by the politically bipartisan Congressional Executive Commission on China accused Beijing of embarking on an unprecedented repression of ethnic minorities, saying that such abuses may constitute crimes against humanity. The commission's chairman is Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
Today, what we see is an ascendant and increasingly aggressive China seeking to not just supplant the United States on the world stage, but reshape global norms on development, trade, the internet, and even human rights. All the while, the fundamental authoritarian character of China's political system under the Communist Party remains unchanged and, in fact, becomes more brutal. Human rights conditions have deteriorated again this year, and that has adversely affected both U.S.-China relations and the people of China's ability to exercise their fundamental human freedoms.
Rubio said of particular concern is the mass arbitrary internment of as many as a million or more Uyghurs and other Muslim ethnic minorities in politically re-education camps in western China. Rubio displayed a photo of one of those camps.
As many as 1 million or more Uyghur and other Muslims are being held in camps just like this. Individuals are arbitrarily detained, and in many cases, detention appears to be indefinite. Local orphanages are reportedly overcrowded with Uyghur children whose parents were taken away to a camp such as this.
The report had some suggestions.
First, embed human rights throughout our bilateral relations. Second, prioritize reciprocity in every area of our bilateral relationship, including diplomacy, trade, investment, media, and cultural and academic exchanges. It's very simple. We should be treating them and their companies, their government, their products, their services the same way they treat us. Third, holding Chinese officials accountable for abuses through sanctions and visa denials and the like. Fourth, promoting internet freedom and counter foreign disinformation here and abroad. And fifth, revamp export controls to ensure that American technology is not being used to commit or facilitate gross rights violations.
Chinese authorities have denied the existence of the internment camps, but said that petty criminals are sent to employment training centers. The Xinjiang government this week did revise legislation to officially permit the use of education and training centers to reform people influenced by extremism. The U.S. report follows a similar assessment by the United Nations, which in August said that allegations of large-scale arbitrary detentions of Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities were deeply disturbing. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. Three senior newspaper journalists were put on trial in Myanmar after they were arrested for their investigation into the Yangon government's finances. Pathong Thai Sinawat, the son of former Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, is released on bail after being put on trial for money laundering charges, accused of taking $300 million in relation to an illicit loan scheme. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen issues the country's National Day celebrations, uses it to express concern with China as a source of conflict, while the opposition party and its supporters focus on building a more cooperative relationship with its cross-strait neighbor. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA Asia. South Korea's foreign minister said Wednesday her government is considering lifting its sanctions against North Korea. That was in response to a question about the so-called May 24th action, a reference to sanctions imposed following the 2010 torpedo attack on the South Korean warship, the Cheonan, in which 45 sailors died. The move would be considered largely symbolic, given the breadth of international sanctions over the North's missile and nuclear activities. Meanwhile, prospects for a second U.S.-North Korea summit appear to have brightened, with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying the two sides are, in his words, pretty close to agreement on details. President Donald Trump said the venue is down to three or four locations, but it likely will not happen until after the November 6th U.S. congressional elections. And he pointed to incredible progress made toward denuclearization.
You have no rockets flying, you have no missiles flying, you have no nuclear testing, you have nuclear closings, they're closing up different areas of North Korea. We're getting the remains back, it's already started, of our great heroes. We got our hostages back, and I didn't pay $1.8 billion like the previous administration, but I have agreed to meet. And we have a very good relationship with Chairman Kim, which is very important. I like him, he likes me, the relationship is good. We've made a lot of progress, and this meeting really is to, you know, people don't realize the importance of the first meeting. I mean, we said, point number one, denuclearization. And they continue to agree, and they continue. Now, we haven't removed sanctions, as you know, people said, what have we done? We haven't removed sanctions. We have very big sanctions. I'd love to remove them, but we have to get something for doing it.
Pompeo said, while there is still a long way to go and much work to do, we can now see a path where we will achieve the full and final verified denuclearization of North Korea. Stephen Norper, senior director at the New York-based Korea Society, told VOA's Victor Beatty many analysts have greeted such statements with skepticism.
Essentially, many were hoping that there would be a commitment towards a statement or declaration of North Korean capabilities, and also the need for verification. North Korea seems to have said it was a success, as clearly did Pompeo and Trump, but it has lent itself really only to a few things. One is the possibility of an inspection at the Sohae site, which is where the rocket engines were worked on, and secondly, something along the line of an inspection at Punggye-ri, which is the nuclear site where the demolitions occurred. So that's closed, but they said that they'll open it for UN inspection to verify. But that's not really enough. There was no mention of Yongbyon, and there was no mention of the broader statement of what North Korea really has, which is probably multiple facilities and a good deal of stockpile now of nuclear weapons.
Well, if there is a real movement toward a second summit, they obviously must have something that they will hope to accomplish.
They do. Clearly, for the North Koreans, it's movement towards an end-of-war statement and evolution toward a peace treaty or peace regime. The South Koreans have urged American patience to try to get there to do that first, and that perhaps a declaration would follow. It's unclear what the White House strategy would be, but again, critics and skeptics are saying not enough is being done from the U.S. side to really get to what the United States has asked for, which is a declaration and verification.
Well, that leads to my next question. The president noted that the U.S. has not lifted the, what he called, very big sanctions imposed on Pyongyang. He said, quote, I'd love to remove them, but we have to get something for doing it. What might that be?
A statement or a declaration of capabilities and a real commitment to let the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA inspectors in, and perhaps other types of verification that would involve U.S. and other international observers. But that would have to be accomplished. Both Trump now and Pompeo at the United Nations General Assembly really underscored that there should not be a lessening of any sanctions. However, clearly the sanctions regime is under challenge as China and Russia have urged an easing and as North Korea seems to have been stoking its argument with them.
In a related story, Stephen, what do you make of South Korea's presidential office statement released that North Korean leader Kim has invited Pope Francis to visit Pyongyang, that he ardently would welcome the Pope to visit?
Well, it's an interesting invitation, and it seems on the face of it that it is not something that would be likely given the atrocious repression of religion in North Korea and the concern about human rights violations in North Korea. However, I would take a slightly different bent than those who only argue that, and that is that this pope has already committed himself to processes of reconciliation. It was because of him that Raul Castro and Barack Obama met and opened up the Cuba relationship. 4 years ago, Pope Francis was in South Korea urging some sort of reconciliation, reunification. If it could be added on to his trip next year that he's committed to for Japan with a stop in South Korea and perhaps a day up in North Korea, maybe that becomes viable.
Meanwhile, the United Nations World Food Program Tuesday warned the food supply in North Korea remains precarious, with 1 in 5 children stunted by malnutrition. The WFP said fully 10 million North Koreans, nearly 40% of the entire population, was undernourished and in need of humanitarian aid. Happening now in Asia, Afghanistan civilians continue to die in record numbers, according to a new report released Wednesday by the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. From the start of the year to the end of September, the UN documented 8,050 civilian casualties, of which 2,800 died and 52,500 were wounded. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. The premier of New South Wales wants immigration to Australia's most populous state halved, insisting that it is buckling under the pressure of too many people. As Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, the leader is blaming successive federal governments for losing control of migration.
Gladys Berejiklian is the daughter of Armenian migrants, but says that Australia is opening its doors to too many new settlers. She says she is an enthusiastic supporter of multiculturalism in a country where more than a quarter of the population was born overseas, but stresses that the number of immigrants arriving in New South Wales has more than doubled in a decade. She wants that figure cut in half. The Premier insists that it's unsustainable and is putting an unrelenting strain on the state's roads, hospitals and schools, which can't cope with the influx.
What I've said is we definitely need to take a breather. We need to look at the numbers. The numbers have gone up from around 45,000 about 10 years ago to now 100,000. We're welcoming about 100,000 to New South Wales every year. I'm suggesting that that number needs to be reduced. We need to take a breather. The states have never had a voice when it comes to immigration or population policy. I think that needs to change.
Earlier this year, Australia's population hit 25 million for the first time. The debate is divisive. There is an argument that because of congestion in the major cities and unaffordable housing, that immigration should be scaled back. Then there's the view that migrants reinvigorate the economy. The population is increasing on average by one extra person every 83 seconds. The largest groups of new migrants are coming from India and China. The latest official prediction is that the number of people here will double to almost 50 million over the next 40 years. Another key part of Australia's immigration policies surround refugees. Unauthorised migrants who arrive by boat have been detained in controversial offshore processing camps in the South Pacific. An Australian-sponsored facility in Papua New Guinea closed last year, but asylum seekers and refugees are still being held on the tiny island of Nauru. They have no prospect of being resettled in Australia, under tough measures that the government in Canberra insists protect the nation's maritime borders. Critics, though, say that indefinite offshore detention is cruel and inhumane. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia: India is in the midst of its Me Too moment as leading figures from the country's entertainment and media industries face a volley of accusations of sexual misconduct from growing numbers of women. days, firestorms have a powerful impact. This is VOA Asia Facebook. Each day, visit us for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. There's a new report out that finds a dramatic increase in the amount of economic loss incurred from natural disasters during the past 20 years, with climate-related disasters driving expensive property and infrastructure damage to new heights. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The report finds most people are killed by earthquakes and tsunamis, but it says storms, floods, and other climate-related disasters are causing economic losses to soar. Between 1998 and 2017, disaster-hit countries have reported $2.9 trillion in direct economic losses, 77% resulting from climate change. Data show the United States has suffered the greatest economic losses, nearly $1 trillion, followed by China, Japan, India, and Puerto Rico. A senior official with the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, Ricardo Mena, says rich countries bear the brunt of economic losses, while low- and middle-income countries are disproportionately affected by disasters.
The report shows that because of much higher vulnerability, people in low- and middle-income countries have seven times greater probabilities of being killed by a disaster than people in developed nations.
The report notes those who suffer most from climate change are people in poor countries who contribute least to greenhouse gas emissions. It says this has drastic consequences for their future development. The report warns climate change is increasing the frequency and severity of extreme weather events. It says heat waves will be the biggest problem in the future and will be much harder to manage than storms and floods in rich and poor countries alike. The report urges countries to invest in disaster risk reduction. It calls that the most cost-effective way to reduce the growing risks from climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pakistan has long been a dangerous country for journalists who report on issues like extremism, militancy, religious fundamentalism, or military interference in politics. A country with a history of military coup has recently witnessed an unprecedented period of civilian rule. But journalists say that 10 years of democracy has not strengthened the freedom of the press. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports that new tactics of intimidation are forcing editors and reporters to self-censor.
Chanting, "We want freedom." Journalists in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, marched towards the heart of the city. They're demanding a right to work free of intimidation and harassment. During the past few years, Pakistani journalists have increasingly complained of intimidation aimed at curbing critical reporting. Some veteran journalists who were incarcerated or flogged during past dictatorships have called the current situation worse.
At that time, whatever was happening was visible. There were martial law orders under which newspapers were shut down. Today we have a facade of democracy. The Constitution is intact, but behind the scenes, dark forces are using all means necessary to control journalism.
Dark forces is a euphemism for the country's powerful military establishment and its intelligence agencies. According to the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists, Pakistan's military uses both direct and indirect intimidation to encourage self-censorship. Earlier this week, a prominent journalist, Cyril Almeida, was ordered to appear in court to face accusations of treason, a capital offense. The Human Rights Commission of Pakistan said the move would further choke press freedom in Pakistan.
While the situation is bad all over the country, certain parts of Pakistan are virtual news black holes. Areas like the rest of Balochistan province or the tribal areas bordering Afghanistan, where international media is not free to travel and local journalists fear for their lives if they cover certain issues. Meanwhile, the new party, PTI, that came to power in a July election, says it will ensure press freedom. Faisal Javed Khan of the ruling party said it had a track record of freeing institutions of political interference. However, some journalists say they're already facing pressure to dial back criticism of the new administration. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
The United States has charged a Chinese spy with trying to steal trade secrets from some of the country's top aviation and aerospace companies. The Justice Department announced Wednesday it had arrested Yan Junshu in Belgium on April 1st and had extradited him to the U.S. on Tuesday. It says Xu is a top member of the Ministry of State Security, the Chinese intelligence agency whose members have permission to spy in China and around the world. U.S. Assistant Attorney General for National Security John Demmer says this case is not an isolated incident, said it's all part of an overall economic policy of developing China at American expense. Demmer said we cannot tolerate a nation stealing our firepower and the fruits of our brain power. Well, no one exactly knows why some babies are born prematurely, but some of the smallest premature babies weigh under 1,500 grams. These tiny babies, called micropremies, can't afford to lose an ounce. At Children's Medical Center in Washington, a team of specialists has come up with a plan to give these babies the best chance to live and thrive. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
When JC was born, he weighed just a little more than 736 grams. But look at him now. He no longer looks like the micro preemie he once was.
I was so scared to touch him at first, and he was so small, and I couldn't even change his diaper. I was so nervous and anxious. He just looked so frail. But the nurses were very supportive and encouraging.
JC was born at just 24 weeks. Full-term babies are born between 39 and 40 weeks.
We're going to do an EKG this morning because of the PVCs.
A team of specialists at the NICU, the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, wanted to see if they could help JC and other very small preterm babies boost their weight and improve their chances to thrive.
Preemies in particular have a high incidence of malnutrition, as well as poor development.
Put you back in your belly, okay?
These babies have so little body fat, they can't afford to waste energy. Some are in blanketed incubators to encourage sleep. The team focused on what and when the babies ate.
We noticed that a lot of our practitioners and the way that they were providing feedings for our very low birth weight babies, so those are babies that were born 1,500 grams or less. They're being fed all kinds of different varying ways.
Good job pumping, Mom. It's impressive.
They wanted to make sure all babies were getting the same care to boost calories and improve their nutrition. Wherever possible, the team emphasized mother's milk.
That is what's best for the premature babies. They tolerate it better, has great antibodies.
We know that mother's milk has growth factors in it that can't be replaced with any other substance.
I just kind of separate it to make sure that I have all of the batch numbers.
The team standardized nutrition practices. They can include fortified donor breast milk for babies whose mothers can't provide their own, or fortified mother's milk, or formula, depending on each baby's needs.
I'm very pleased. We have been able to put protocols in place so that there's a standardization of care for these babies and the feeding aspect. We've also increased the amount of mother's own milk we've been providing for the babies, which is great.
We were able to improve their weight by 30%.
The team isn't done yet. They want to tweak the nutrition practices to see if they can improve their results. Once they're finished, They'll publish the results so other micropremies can benefit too. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have yourself a marvelous day.